Wales, it stays dry with some sunshine, but for Bank Holiday Monday, it's turning cooler, cloudy, wetter and windy. That's the forecast.
Thanks, Nina. Now for the final extract from Falling Upwards, Richard Holmes's history of pioneering aeronauts and their balloon exploits. The outstanding example of the extreme record-breaking balloonist was the Swedish engineer Salomon André and his efforts to reach the North Pole by balloon. André and his two companions, Nils Strindberg and Knut Frenkel, launched their huge balloon, the Eagle, from the tip of Spitsbergen on the afternoon of the 11th of July, 1897. It was a chaotic affair in which the balloon just cleared the hangar and only gained height with some indiscriminate offloading of nearly a third of its ballast. But eventually, they rose up into the sky on one of the last great pioneering flights of the Age of Balloons. The reader is Rory Kinnear.
The crew had drunk champagne and were in high spirits. All that first afternoon, the ballooning was smooth, sunlit and bucolic. The wind was carrying them briskly north, though also several degrees eastwards. They were thrilled by the sense of entering so swiftly and so easily into the unknown land of ice and snow. By the end of the first 12 hours, they'd covered some 244 miles, which was genuinely impressive. A sledge would have taken 3 weeks at best to cover the same ground. At around 1:30 a.m. on 12th of July, entering a cloud, the balloon lost the warming influence of the sun and sank steadily into a new world, that of Arctic ground fog. From then on, conditions changed dramatically. Within 4 minutes, the Eagle had dropped from 800 to 65 feet, and for the first time since Spitsbergen, one of the shortened drag ropes touched the ice. The balloon would never again rise above 300 feet. Their mood darkened. Nils Strindberg noticed a huge blood-red stain on the ice where a polar bear had made a kill. It seemed ominous. At the new low altitude, the balloon slowed to almost walking pace. Worse, it gradually turned completely around and started to drift westwards. They were virtually retracing their steps. The basket actually struck the ice forcibly several times in succession. By 5:14 p.m., they had had 8 strikes in 30 minutes. This was menacing. As they sank into the freezing fog, the sun disappeared altogether. The ice no longer glinted and shimmered, its blue and white beauty replaced by a dreary, featureless grey. The balloon was growing heavier every hour with moisture from the freezing fog, and the lifting power of the remaining hydrogen was reducing as its temperature dropped. The wind direction had swung further round and was now threatening to blow them almost due west. Finally, they stopped moving altogether. One of the drag ropes had become caught beneath a block of ice. After 22 hours flying, they were supposed to be over halfway to the pole, but they had not reached even 82 degrees north. They would remain stuck for the next 13 hours. André wrote in his journal soon after the others had gone below to rest. 11:45 p.m., 12th of July. Although we could have thrown out ballast, and although the wind, now blowing due west, might perhaps carry us to Greenland, we determined to be content with standing still. We have been obliged to throw out very much ballast today, and have not had any sleep nor been allowed any rest from the repeated bumpings, and we could not have stood it much longer. André was now alone on the deck of the stationary Eagle for several hours until early in the morning of 13th of July. It was a rare moment of solitary command, a historic pause. The heroic aeronaut aboard the greatest of the 19th century free balloons. At some point he opened his journal on his knee and made his longest and his only personal entry during the entire expedition. Is it not a little strange to be floating here above the polar sea? To be the first that have floated here in a balloon? Shall we be thought mad, or will our example be followed? I cannot deny but that all three of us are dominated by feelings of pride. We think we can well face death, having done what we've done. Is not the whole endeavour, perhaps, the expression of an extremely strong sense of individuality, which cannot bear the thought of living and dying like a man in the ranks, forgotten by coming generations. The truly surprising feature of this entry is its philosophical resignation. It is almost as if the whole expedition is already over. By mid-morning on 13th of July, the capricious wind had come round through nearly 180 degrees and was blowing eastwards once more. The trail rope, pulled in the reverse direction, suddenly broke free from the ice, knocking them all off their feet. They were now sailing back eastwards on an almost reciprocal course. They resorted to a hot meal, washed down with several bottles of the King's Special Ale. At 5 p.m. that day, they crossed back over exactly the same point at which they had been 25 hours earlier, at 4 p.m. on 12th of July. The balloon had simply performed a huge west-east dog's leg. They had covered a further 200 miles over the ice, but got not a mile nearer the pole. It was now clear that the fog had frozen yet more moisture onto the balloon canopy and network cords, adding hundreds of pounds to her weight. The only possible remedy was now so extreme that it would be a complete aeronautical gamble. Unless they threw out some of the equipment in the upper storage cone, which consisted of the tinned food, the spare ammunition, the sledges, the tent, the collapsible boat, and the cooking fuel, all of it vital for survival down on the ice, the Eagle would never rise again. Clearly, Andre concluded that it was too much of a gamble. At 6:20 the following morning, 14th of July, he released further gas and started to bring the balloon down on what looked like a relatively smooth section of the ice floe. It was a fearful decision. From this moment, they were no longer aerial beings, but were committed to the ice and to crawling painfully over one of the cruelest surfaces on the planet. Led by Andre, all three scrambled out and stood bleakly on the frozen, featureless plateau. It was a grim prospect. Their huge, proud balloon was a slack, half-deflated dome of tattered silk, crackling with frost, a mere piece of debris. Beyond, there was no sun and no clear horizon in any direction. It was true that they had travelled 517 miles over the ice and had landed without injury, and with most of their equipment and instruments intact. That was a genuine achievement. But they were still over 400 miles short of the pole. On the 22nd of July, after 8 days of preparation, they abandoned the Eagle's gondola and the wreckage of the balloon. They cut up a section of the Eagle's silken fabric to protect their tent, and perhaps also as a memento of their great and disastrous flight, and began the long march south on the shifting ice floes. Andre calculated that they had between 200 and 250 miles to cover, depending on ice drift, and approximately 110 days of Arctic sunlight left in which to cover it. It was not impossible. Initially, they made good progress of several miles a day. They hunted for food as they went, mostly shooting polar bear. But there was one fatal circumstance which only slowly became clear as Andre studied Frankel's irregular sextant sightings on the declining sun on its rare appearances. They were covering their daily distance over the ice roughly as planned. Yet the Arctic ice pack was itself drifting northwards almost as swiftly as they walked south. More than once, after a succession of hard days marching, their sextant bearings showed that they had actually moved several miles north. This agonizing process held them in thrall for the next 2 months. By mid-September, the weather was closing in and the sunlight failing. But at last, the pack ice was drifting due south again, and with growing speed. They determined to conserve the last of their energy and provisions, and allow themselves simply to drift with it. On 17th of September, they had their first sight of land since leaving Spitsbergen. It turned out to be tiny White Island, the most extreme northeasterly of the Spitsbergen archipelago, a mere 17 miles long and dominated by an enormous 600-foot glacier. They were completely isolated in the polar sea. But the possibility of drifting southwestwards past White Island and then all the way home now became vivid. On the 18th, they held a banquet to celebrate. They ate seal steaks and gâteau au raisin with raspberry syrup sauce, drank a bottle of 1834 Antonio de Ferrara port given by the Swedish king, and sang the national anthem. They were not behaving like doomed men. In preparation for the last part of their journey, they reconnoitred a large ice floe several hundred metres across and began to construct a snow hut or igloo at its centre. But on the night of 2nd of October, their ice flow suddenly started to break up, revealing a great chasm of icy black water below, which they only just prevented from devouring half their equipment. In the morning, they repacked and prepared to take to their boat at a moment's notice. They were all deeply shaken. Andrei made a solemn entry in his diary. No one has lost courage. With such comrades, one should be able to manage, I may say, under any circumstances. The following day, it became clear that the perilous condition of the pack ice would force them to land on White Island after all. They journeyed approximately 190 miles across the surface of the ice from the Eagle's landing point. But owing to the ice pack's drift, their position was still about 200 miles east of the nearest supply dump on Spitsbergen. White Island was now their only hope. It was a bleak one. Their binoculars revealed a low, windswept, stony, and utterly inhospitable shore, partially crusted with snow. Behind it, in the ever-fading light, reared the looming glacier. But it was still land. They were now reduced to the most elemental state of survival. Andre's diary is fragmentary and finally incoherent after the last great effort of reaching White Island. One broken entry runs, "Bad weather and we fear. We keep in the tent the whole day so that we could work on the butt to escape." Exactly how the Eagle expedition ended only emerged a generation later. In 1930, a Norwegian whaling ship anchored for 24 hours off the beach at White Island. A shore party were astonished to come across the half-buried remains of one of the Eagle's sledges. After further searches in the snow, two bodies and various documents were found. Most precious of all were Nils Strindberg's sealed tins of exposed photographic film. The scene they finally established was this. The skeletons of André and Frankel, much pulled about by polar bears, lay within a driftwood frame constructed beneath a shelf of rock. Frankel lay flat, with open boxes of medical equipment scattered around him. André was half propped against the rock, a loaded rifle at his side. Supplies of tinned food, fuel, and ammunition littered around the camp showed that they had not starved. But much equipment had never been unpacked. Death must have come quite soon, through exhaustion, illness, or hypothermia, or a combination of all three. The disposition of objects suggested that André had died last, having administered what medical aid he could to the dying Frankel, and then taken up his final half-sitting position as captain on his last watch. Further investigation of the rock shelf revealed a natural fissure about 6 feet long, 30 yards or so to the west of the camp. It had been carefully filled with large, flat stones to make a kind of cairn. It was Nils Strindberg's grave. It had been lovingly and laboriously constructed at what must have been a terrible cost to the dwindling physical reserves of his two comrades. But the immense care they took with his body and his personal effects showed how much they valued him to the end. They wrapped up his letters to his fiancée, Anna, as well as a gold locket with her miniature and his almanac. Instead of leaving Nils's engagement ring on his finger, they removed it and placed it with the letters. One of Salomon André's last acts was to put all these precious objects, together with Frankel's observation journal and his own unfinished diary, in meticulously sealed wrappings, which he placed next to his own body, where they might eventually be found. As the final remnants of their camp were collected and analysed in 1930, it became clear that the driftwood frame of their shelter had once been covered by some sort of fabric. Closer inspection proved that part of it was cloth from the Eagle. So the last thing André's eyes rested upon may have been the silken balloon canopy billowing overhead in the Arctic wind. He may even have dreamed that he was still flying.
Rory Kinnear was reading the final extract from Falling Upwards by Richard Holmes. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. From the air to the sea with the shipping forecast in a moment. That's after sailing by. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 25th of May. There are warnings of gales in White, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Trafalgar and Fitzroy. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Iceland, 998, slow moving, filling 1004 by 1800 Saturday. New low expected northwest Fitzroy, 1019 by same time. Low White, 1005, moving away southwards and losing its identity. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. West Viking, variable 4, fair, good. East Viking, northerly 5 or 6, decreasing 4,